Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 292 for Friday, March 7th, 2014. By the time this episode hits the nets, I will, if all goes according to plan, be in Austin, Texas, along with 40,000 other attendees of South by Southwest. Not all of them will be partaking of the 800-plus workshops and events offered by the Interactive track, but I think Interactive may account for almost half, with the rest headed for the music, film, and comedy parts of South by Southwest. I'm going to be staying again with my cousin Peter Tai, who is a great cook. He's got some barbecue ribs on tap for tomorrow night, Thursday. He's also a shrewd analyst of technology that brings book reading to the blind, so I'm looking forward to his latest insights on that topic. I'm putting the show together on Wednesday, March 5th. That's the day after I reached New Yorker staff writer George Packer for the interview. We talked about his latest book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America, as well as his 12,000-word New Yorker piece about Amazon and the book industry. Writing a book is never easy, but Packer faced an altogether separate set of challenges in reporting his Amazon article.
Not only was I being shut out of Amazon, but I also had this guy, Brad Stone, who'd been at this for years, doing a pretty damn good job of digging up stuff that very secretive corporation doesn't really want people to know.
So in news, Neil Gaiman, a highly original author from the UK, is someone that I just like listening to as well as reading. The latest book of his that I recommend is a novel, The Ocean at the End of the Lane, published in June of last year. He makes things up and writes them down, as he says in his Amazon author profile, and the result is usually memorable, inspiring, and amusing. When it comes to the serious topic of book pirates, copyright, and what makes sense as a way to connect with readers, Gaiman posted a 4-minute video a month ago in which he spoke to a group named the Open Rights Group. He began by noting that he used to feel very grumpy when people posted his work on the web without his permission, but then he noticed that the more this happened, the more books he sold. Well, 6 o'clock here in Denver. A little ahead of schedule. That's not too bad. So as I said, he noticed that when his material was being put up on the web, he'd sell more books. And in fact, he persuaded his publisher to put American Gods, which was a book of his that was still selling well, up free on their website just to see what would happen. Sales of his books through independent bookstores, as a result of that experiment, rose by 300% the next month. Then he began asking audiences how many of them discovered their favorite authors by having a book loaned to them versus buying that author's book for the first time in a store. So we'll pick up the end of this video and he'll explain what he learned.
And it's probably about 5-10%, if that, of the people actually discovered an author who is their favorite author, who is the person they buy everything of, and they buy the hardbacks, and they treasure the fact that they've got this author. Very few of them bought the book. They were lent it. They were given it. They did not pay for it. And that's how they found their favorite author. And I thought, you know, that's really all this is. It's people lending books. And you can't look on that as a lost sale. It's not a lost sale. Nobody who would have bought your book is not buying it because they can find it for free. What you're actually doing is advertising. You're reaching more people. You're raising awareness. And understanding that gave me a whole new idea of the shape of copyright and of what the web was doing. Because the biggest thing the web is doing is allowing people to hear things, allowing people to read things, allowing people to see things that they might never have otherwise seen. And I think basically that's an incredibly good thing.
This video has been viewed 277,764 times and generated 691 comments on YouTube. So is what he's talking about good for the book? I think so. And if you want to understand what's happening to the book, I think it helps to tune into the ongoing thinking of Neil Gaiman and other explorers of this space. I'll have a link to the video in the show notes. Turning to the tech tip, Guven Vitoveen recently emailed me a link to a post at makeuseof.com, which is an increasingly useful site for mini tech tutorials on a wide variety of topics. This one is titled How to Learn a Language Using the Kindle Paperwhite by Justin Dennis. It's a very thorough description of how to use the Paperwhite second generation to bone up on a language that you already sort of know. It wouldn't be good for a brand new look at a language. And so if this interests you, please check out the show notes at thekindlechronicles.com. And it's a very nice bit of clear technical writing that'll walk you step by step on how to download a dictionary from your second language that you're learning to English and set it up so that you can identify words in a book in a foreign language and learn, and then also use the vocabulary builder to do some good job learning the language. George Packer has been a staff writer for The New Yorker since 2003. He covered the Iraq War for the magazine, and his book, The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq, was named one of the 10 best books of 2005 by The New York Times. His latest book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America, won last year's National Book Award for Nonfiction. In February, The New Yorker published a 12,000-word story by Packer titled Cheap Words, Amazon is Good for Customers, But Is It Good for Books? As it happens, I met George Packer briefly more than 10 years ago when he was on the nonfiction faculty at the Bennington Graduate Writing Seminars. Since I was earning an MFA in poetry at Bennington, I never did have Packer as a teacher, but I visited with him at least once at a social gathering, and I was impressed with the seriousness and depth of his work. I had a similarly positive reaction to The Unwinding, but as I've mentioned here in past shows, I was very disappointed with Packer's recent article about Amazon. It seemed to me that he waded into this very fraught battle of Amazon against the traditional publishers with an obvious bias in favor of the publishers. As you will hear, Packer resists the suggestion that his piece was a love letter to the Big Five because he pointed out that they have been complacent and short-term in their thinking. Now, I would point out that by comparison, he quoted people asserting that Amazon is a ruthless predator that only claims to want a literate world, that the vast majority of Amazon employees are like smart MIT graduates who have no idea what to say to a woman at a bar, that few members of the Kindle division at Amazon have a real interest in books, that working at Amazon is like serving the Vichy France government that collaborated with the Nazis, and that everyone in the Kindle division is so engineering-oriented that they don't know how to talk to novelists. I confess that even as I prepared that partial list of cheap shots and weighed against what Packer apparently believes to be comparable criticism of traditional publishers by calling them gasp, complacent short-term thinkers, I get a little irritated, and I've gotten more irritated each time I've read that article. So that's the background for the conversation that you're about to hear, recorded on Tuesday, March 4th by Skype between Packer's home in New York and mine in Denver. I began by asking him what readers will learn about changes in America since the 1970s by reading his latest book, The Unwinding.
I think the big picture is that some of the main institutions that used to be the foundations of a middle-class democracy where prosperity was pretty widely shared and where political power was not concentrated in just a few hands. Those institutions, which include government, unions, corporations, news organizations, schools, universities, a lot of them have deteriorated, eroded, stopped working on behalf of large numbers of Americans, become narrower in their focus, maybe become less competent. And as a result, we're more and more of a winner-take-all society where there isn't much in the way of barriers to the rise of economic inequality and the separation of Americans into different political camps and into different economic camps. So we're just a more atomized and separated society with less equality, at least less economic equality than 35 years ago. And I think it's partly because the institutions and the elites who led them have stopped carrying out the mission that they had in that post-war years of the social contract.
the three main characters that you spend a lot of time with, Dean Price, Tammy Thomas, and Peter Thiel, wildly different backgrounds in terms of where they are in the country and where they are in society. But you've said that there was a running theme to their stories, and that it was a complete lack of confidence in elites who seemed to stand for something beyond their own interests and therefore had the authority that came with their privilege that allowed them to lead institutions. You kept yourself out of the book in terms of offering your opinions and certainly prescriptions for how to fix the problems you identify, but it did seem that you were sort of in tune with them in not having much faith in those elites. Is that a correct reading of sort of your approach to the book and where writing the book brought you?
Yeah, there's a strong point of view in the book, but you're right. I made a decision early on not to use the first person, not to speak directly to the reader without the mediating, you know, voice of a character. And that character might be Dean Price or Tammy Thomas or Peter Thiel or Jeff Connaughton, who's a career Washington insider, another important character, or the city of Tampa and environs, which is a character all by itself during the period of housing boom and bust. There's also 10 portraits of celebrities from different sectors. From politics, there's Newt Gingrich. From entertainment, there's there's Oprah Winfrey. From business, there's Sam Walton. From finance, there's Robert Rubin. From food, there's Alice Waters. So the reader meets these figures who shaped the culture during that 35 year period and through their voices as well, not in the first person, but in an indirect way, using their way of talking, their language, their way of seeing themselves. So all of that is in the interest of just creating a picture of the country and not doing it in a prescriptive or polemical way, but doing it more as a novelist would. The inspiration for the form was John Dos Passos' great USA trilogy from the 30s, a real masterpiece of American modernism. And so, you know, some reviewers said, well, there's no answers here. There's no prescriptions. There isn't a tangible ideology or philosophy behind all this. And that is true. But I think if I had provided that, it would have suck the life out of the narrative, which is what the book is about. And to answer your question briefly, yeah, I think that the lives of the celebrities that you read in the book show you that the path to great success and great wealth doesn't necessarily involve building something that lasts or creating something that helps, you know, large numbers of people. It's a kind of empire and brand building that in the end seems to be more about itself, success for its own sake in a lot of cases.
Well, turning to your New Yorker piece about Amazon, cheap words, I wondered if you felt any disconnect or contradiction. Because in that piece, you end up giving a pretty favorable look at the elite that is running the big publishing companies, talking that they're gatekeepers representing barriers against the complete commercialization of ideas, allowing new talent the time to develop and learn to tell difficult truths. As someone who's been covering ebooks in the Kindle for 5 years and with a very enthusiastic following of people that have made this shift to reading this way, it seems like pretty often we've felt a little bit like Dean Price or Tammy Thomas in the way the elite of the publishing industry has been responding to our desire to read in this very exciting new way. Of keeping the prices high and windowing books. In the early days, you'd have to wait 6 weeks to read Game Change on your Kindle because they're going to try to support the hardcover. Why, when it came to big publishing, do you end up sort of a fan of an elite, whereas this major book, that you were pretty much running in the other direction?
Well, a couple of things. First, the piece is not so rosy about the big six or the big five. It calls them complacent, short-sighted. It talks about their folly in going after a few blockbusters and ignoring or moving away from what used to be called mid-list books, which are quieter, less commercial books that are going to last. So it's not a fan letter for New York publishers. So I think that's a bit of a distortion. But what you've left out is the other big elite in the story, which is Amazon. And that's a strange omission because it, by any measure, whether it's market power or revenues or political power, Amazon dwarfs the big publishers. And the tech, Amazon and the tech companies in general are the new trusts, the new corporations that are our version of the oil trust, John D. Rockefeller, the railroad trust, Union Pacific, the banking trust, J.P. Morgan, that dominated our economy at the end of the 19th century and that led to antitrust law and the progressive movement. So I don't, you know, the omission of Amazon from your question suggests that Amazon is just this helper, this sort of invisible but helpful force that brings books to readers and brings readers to books and makes them cheap for everybody. And isn't that all good? Amazon is a titanic corporation with an enormous amount of wealth and power and does things in a rapacious and ruthless way for its own interest, which is what corporations have always done. So I think it's odd that the tech world in some cases gets a pass because the internet doesn't seem to belong to anybody and because there's a voluntary participation in it by all of us and because we don't see images of a factory floor or of a railroad gang. And so we don't imagine that there's a human cost in the growth of the tech giants. But I think there is. And in the case of books, what the article unearths is a structure of book selling that has made it harder for publishers who are at fault as well, but for them to continue to invest time and money in the kind of difficult but important projects that that I think is their historic mission. So, just as in The Unwinding, there's a criticism of elites and the institutions they lead, but not a nihilism that says let's get rid of institutions and have a wide open marketplace where there are no barriers to commerce. On the contrary, if I were to make my argument in The Unwinding, would be we need to rebuild them. We need to have more responsible elites because without those institutions in both politics and business and finance and technology, what we've seen, and there's been a democratization in all of those in different ways, but what we've seen is it always ends up with money being concentrated in ever fewer hands and power being concentrated in ever fewer hands. And that's why in that piece, I found fault with Amazon, not for creating Kindle Direct Publishing, but for creating a marketplace in which it's harder and harder for publishers to get behind difficult books and to pay writers enough to have them spend years of their lives, you know, writing them.
Well, and I think Kindle Direct Publishing is the other part that I wish there had been more in the piece about. It was mentioned just briefly that it was very successful. But there's data coming out from a self-published author, Hugh Howie, that's showing that on three different dates, analyzing ebook data from Amazon and Barnes & Noble, more than a third of the revenue of thousands of best-selling books is going to self-published authors, thanks to Kindle Direct Publishing, and you know, Barnes & Noble has its own version. So this just seems to be a large and growing area that Amazon made possible, which it certainly doesn't control in terms of content. It's a kind of a blank slate that is giving thousands of authors a chance to do difficult work and to get 70% royalties as a result. And by focusing just on the existing publishing industry and mainly the big five, it seems like you overlooked a pretty big piece of what's really happening in the evolution of the book.
Yeah, I could have spent a lot of time going around talking to self-publishing authors and hearing their experiences. I read about their experiences online, about a lot of them, actually. You know, partly Amazon didn't open that door. And I wish they had. They never said, come out to Seattle, talk to the people who run Kindle Direct Publishing. We'll put you in touch with these authors. We'll put you in touch with our genre people. They, as is their habit, they kept such tight control over the flow of information, which I think is a dangerous way to be involved in the publishing of books and perhaps even the publishing of a newspaper. But they kept the door firmly closed. They gave me a couple of on-the-record interviews with some higher-ups who, you know, it was good of them to do that, but they were relentlessly on message and didn't, you know, invite further inquiry or bring me out to Seattle. I wish they had. It would have been much better.
Well, it sounded like at first you expected that, and then there was kind of a change in your interview with the Los Angeles Times. Did that happen when Brad Stone's book came out? I wondered if that was...
I don't know. I mean, they said initially, the head of PR said, we'd love to do this with you, and we'll talk to Jeff, and no reason why it shouldn't happen. I mean, they were very open to my doing a fairly full-throated... profile of Jeff Bezos, which was the original conception for the piece. Around the time the Everything Store was headed for publication, I stopped hearing from them. And then when I pressed them, I was told that that offer was not going to be made good, and that I was not going to get to talk to Bezos or, you know, go out to headquarters or anything.
I think the date when it changed might have been November 4th, when Mackenzie Bezos's one-star review of Brad's book hit. I have a feeling they thought that Brad Stone's book was going to be very different than the way it turned out. And, you know, I think maybe they overreacted some.
You think it was a really critical picture of Amazon and Bezos? Because I thought it was not. It was not so...
Well, I think so it harsh. Was. I thought it was an excellent book and amazing research. But if I were Amazon, worried about, when are they going to go through some kind of an antitrust battle like A&P or Microsoft? Anything that portrays them as predatory and rapacious is of concern. And you know, Brad had that amazing Amazon.love memo that showed they're very aware of this. So, and the problem was that if you read the whole book, you got a full nuanced view of the company. But if you read only Julie Bosman's quotes from it in the New York Times or David Streitfeld, the headlines were Amazon portrayed as a brutal entity.
Yeah, and I think that's always the case that the news version of a book just doesn't do it justice. I thought it was a terrific book. I learned a lot from it. It actually made my job a lot harder because not only was I being shut out of Amazon, but I also had this guy, Brad Stone, who'd been at this for years, doing a pretty damn good job of digging up stuff that very secretive corporation doesn't really want people to know. So in the end, I focused on Amazon and culture because it's mainly about books, but it's also about Amazon and television, Amazon and Jeff Bezos and the Washington Post, because I'm just interested in what happens when these essentially technology companies that have not been interested in content, but interested only in selling it or creating platforms for it or creating content management systems, when they actually start making things. And so I actually focused more on Amazon's New York publishing arm than on the Seattle operation for that reason. Because it seemed like their bid to beat the New York publishers on their own turf.
one aspect of it that of your piece that I thought was different than Brad's was you had a number of times where you seemed to be leaving the impression that Jeff Bezos is not an avid reader or lover of books and that Amazon is kind of an anti-book culture. There was quite a different take in Brad's book. He talks about Jeff being 12 years old, reading The Hobbit and talking about it in an articulate way.
Yeah, but everyone reads The Hobbit at 12.
Well, and he also said that he learns more from fiction than he does from nonfiction and that books are have driven the culture of Amazon. So, I mean, if you were just going to say, all right, is this a book-friendly CEO or culture, you would get a really different take in Stone's book than in your piece, I think. And I wonder if your reporting varied from his that left you thinking that Bezos really is a Philistine when it comes to books.
I don't think he's a Philistine. I just think his attitude is pragmatic. You know, my reporting took me to Shel Kapan, who was his number two for a long time, and who told me that the purpose of becoming an online bookseller was entirely pragmatic. It was entirely based on the properties that books have as commodities, which is they're easy to ship, they're not fragile, and there's an almost infinite variety of them, which gives a huge advantage to an online store over a bricks and mortar store. It made perfect sense. And I actually said it was a stroke of business genius for Bezos to see that. But it's a stroke of business genius. It's not a stroke of literary genius. And, you know, if I saw some more evidence, then I would incorporate that. But everyone, you know, Stone says he read Kazuo Ishiguro. Apparently he had the time of the reading wrong. Well, it's just The Hobbit and Kazuo Ishiguro do not make someone a mad lover of literature. And the Ishiguro book seems to have mainly been become part of the Bezos canon for its pragmatic effect, which is what he called the regret minimization framework, which is to say, don't live your life in a way that you'll end up feeling was a waste. And that's not how how I approach novels, not as a guide to you know, a how-to book about how to live my life.
Well, in the aftermath of the article, do you have any regrets about the portrait of Amazon that you wrote? Would it have been more favorable to their cause if you'd had more access, do you think?
Yes, it absolutely would have. And that's almost always true, unless you're doing something illegal, which I don't think they are, although Apple seemed to have some other ideas about that. And then it's always better to bring a reporter in and to give him a chance to talk to people and to hear from people other than ex-employees who don't want to go on the record because they don't want to be blacklisted. And that's what I had some people on the record, but it's very hard to get people on the record who've worked at Amazon and also in the publishing business because they have a sense of a somewhat vengeful former employer. So it would have been much better. I think that you were onto something when you said I should have looked harder at the self-publishing side of things, because I think that late in the work I began to realize just how extensive it is. I mean, I knew the numbers, but the numbers are sort of abstract until you start to hear the stories. I mean, you don't want to take it too far because you also read articles that say the average self-published author makes $500 a year in this country.
Yeah, that was 3 years old in Australia, so it's a bit of outdated information, I think.
But how is it that much higher now? It's still a struggle. I mean, it's a struggle for a non-self-published author to make a living.
Well, that's right. The comparable data would be what percent of people who try to go the traditional route are making less than $500 a year.
I guess I'm also – I don't have the view that you might have, which is – and that some of your listeners might have, which is that there's something completely corrupt about traditional publishing or that it somehow stacked against – all this talent out there that's just waiting to be discovered, that sometimes it turns out that although it has its own form of corruption and coziness, there's also a way in which that talent eventually does find its way to good publishers. And a lot of self-published authors find their way to good publishers as well. So,
yeah, I think it's just a system. You know, Richard Bach, the author of Jonathan Livingston Seagull, tried to get the sequel that talked about his near-death experience in his plane crash published, and he couldn't find a traditional publisher. So David Blum published it the minute Bach submitted it over the transom.
To Kindle Singles, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, you know, obviously sold hundreds of thousands of copies. But to me, you don't even have to be an unknown author to sometimes find that doors are closed in New York, and then here in Seattle, you send an email and you're published within 2 weeks, a book of some significance and merit.
And that's a good thing. And it's obviously been a great thing for people who couldn't get their work read or published in New York. I mean, listen, in my 20s and 30s, I spent a lot of painful days railing against both book publishers and magazines, fighting to get heard, fighting to get in literally into their front door. I know that pain very. I still have vivid memories of it, even if right now it seems, you know, like it's somewhat in the past. So I'm pretty damn sympathetic to people who feel that they haven't been heard or haven't been given a shot. But it's Amazon that I'm interested in, and that's why I put the focus not so much on self-published authors as on Amazon itself and its effect on the structure and the economics of book publishing, and I was critical of that. And I'm afraid I've got to run. My car is going to get ticketed towed if I don't.
Thanks very much, George. Appreciate the time.
Thank you for having me on.
As a postscript to this interview, I'd like to add a few words. If Packer was possibly prompted by our conversation to take another look at the revolution in self-publishing, he helped me to an epiphany about not getting trapped in a blindly adversarial stance toward publishing in the traditional sector. I wanted to say no, no when he suggested that I and my listeners might have that sort of unthinking bias against the Big Five, but the truth is that I find it a challenge sometimes not to end up there. The wiser heads in this space, like author Hugh Howey, blogger Porter Anderson, and to some extent Mike Schatzkin, have friends in both camps and understand the assets and liabilities of both Amazon and the traditional publishing sector. We're all feeling our way here toward an understanding of what's really happening to books and reading. So for my part, I do intend to try to connect with people at the Big Five for interviews and a better understanding of the challenges they face. Maybe George Packer will be able to put me in touch with some of his friends for some interviews. And also, if you know of a good prospect for an interview guest who might help me to stick to this resolution, please email me at podchronicles@gmail.com. As I prepared for my interview with Packer, I watched a YouTube video of his reading from The Unwinding in May of last year in Washington, D.C. at Politics and Prose, which he called the best independent bookstore in the nation. In the Q&A, he stated that generalizations that say we are all this way or we are all that way always have some truth, but then always leave you dissatisfied, because they don't take you into the essential truth. His deep pursuit of the inner life of this country in The Unwinding, I think, avoided that failure, and I think readers of many different points of view are finding it to be a troubling, but at the same time, oddly, a deeply satisfying portrait of America. By comparison, I think the New Yorker piece may leave even bitter foes of Amazon dissatisfied to the extent that they are still curious about the essential truth of what is happening to the book. I did appreciate George Packer's coming on the show, and I hope his car didn't get towed. As always, I welcome your thoughts and comments about this interview. You can email them to me at podchronicles@gmail.com or leave them in the comments area at thekindlechronicles.com. In content, I was tipped off by Garrett Riley that Stephen King's novel Joyland, which was published in print but not ebook format in June of last year, is now finally coming to a Kindle or other e-reader near you. It is available for $6.59 as a pre-order, with delivery set for midnight April 8th, 2014. I reached out to request an interview with Stephen King and received the following reply from Charles R. Day, editor of Hard Case Crime, the publisher of Joyland. Hi, Len. I appreciate your suggesting this, but Steve overloaded on interviews last year and has decided to make this something of a sabbatical from public life. It's possible he might be open to an interview in some future year about some other book, but not this book this year. Apologies, Charles. Also in content, Simon & Schuster has a new website designed to help readers discover favorite books. It's offtheshelf.com. And it highlights previously published books through a daily original review or essay centered on a title released at least 1 year earlier. That's according to the Publisher's Weekly story about the site. Carolyn Reedy, president of Simon & Schuster, she's also the CEO, said in a press release, "While it is very easy to learn about the latest hot new must-have books, we know from experience that many readers are more interested in what's relevant to them, regardless of its moment in the publishing cycle. With Off the Shelf, we aim to bring attention to books that were bestsellers you might have read or wanted to, books that you may have missed in the often overwhelming number of titles that get published every year, or simply books that have touched us as readers, left an indelible mark on us, and become friends that we often revisit." I think this sounds pretty promising. I like the tone of that quote. And if you sign up for the email alert, you get a free ebook. Now, the problem with the free ebook is it's only available on the Kindle Fire, and the process of signing up and getting it I found to be pretty frustrating. You have to sign up for something called BookShout, which entails a different username and password than Off the Shelf. And once signed up, you get a .apk app for BookShout, and once that's set up on the Kindle, you can try to download the free ebook that you selected, and that turns out to be a challenge. I never did get my free ebook showing up on my Kindle Fire. The basic idea here is something that you hear a lot about, the need for the publishing companies to make direct connections with their customers, the readers, and I think this is a promising start, a smart move for them to try to do that. You know, if the free book offer is a little clunky, the rest of the site seems pretty easy to navigate. If you see something in their reviews that you like, you can click on a cover, and then you end up at a page with logos for purchasing it at Amazon, iBooks, Audible, something called BAM, I'm not sure what that is, Barnes & Noble, Google Play, and the American Booksellers Association site, IndieBound. So from you click on Amazon if you want the Kindle version. Make sure that when you land at Amazon, you're really getting the Kindle version. When I clicked on Middlesex by Jeffrey Eugenides, I ended up on the paperback format, so I had to click to the Kindle before I bought the book so that I didn't end up with a paperback. Four clicks from first seeing it at, on the shelf to purchase, compared with two clicks that it would take to buy a book highlighted at Amazon and say the monthly list of $3.99 bargain titles. And now for something completely different, I've been watching a comedy series that E.O. Lake Stubblehouse put me onto. He's a longtime listener in the UK who watches mainly comedy on his video watching with his Kindle Fire and his tablets. So this is called Big Bang Theory. It had seven seasons, and I bought the first season for about $29. It is totally tickling my funny bone. It's a group of brilliant physics nerds all living together across the hall from a beautiful girl who waitresses at the Cheesecake Factory, and just a good normal person living across the hall from these freakishly intelligent people. And it reminds me of that cheap shot in Packer's article about the people saying that everyone at Amazon is like the top of the class kid at MIT who doesn't know how to talk to a woman. And in fact, one of the characters on the Big Bang Theory is an Indian student, and he literally cannot talk to a woman. Anytime he's in the presence of a woman, he just will not talk. So maybe there's some kind of overlap there, at least a coincidence. This won't be everyone's cup of tea. Some of it's a little bawdy, but it's very smart. There a lot of the dialogue gets into these riffs on science, and there's clearly some people that know their science that have put the thing together, and it's just funny. Time now for a couple of your comments. The first comes from Al McDermott, a longtime listener from Kentucky, who wrote, "Len, your interview with Richard Bach was really appreciated. I had not known that he was an Air Force pilot. As you may know, I was a Navy pilot flying off the old converted World War II carriers that had been converted to CVS types, which were specifically anti-submarine. I flew the S-2F, which we called Stoofs. You also triggered something in me when you mentioned proofreading. I came up with a scheme to offer indies a deal where I proof their books when they think they are ready for publication, charging $1 per error that I find. They have to agree with the errors, and they can put a limit on them so that they keep the cost to something expected. If I reach that limit, then I send them what I have. So far, I've made more money than on all the articles I've sold. I have found that homonyms are a big problem, probably because of the generations that were taught to read phonetically. The funniest one was the guy who was hunting for prey, P-R-A-Y, instead of P-R-E-Y. Keep up the good work, Al. Al also echoed Karina's observations last week that the Kindle is the perfect way to proof. He chimes in and says, for some reason, the errors pop out more clearly than on the computer screen. Also, I like to proof on the Kindle keyboard. For my own writing, I also listen to it and pause anything that sounds wrong. I highlight them, then when done, I go to My Clippings and capture that section about the book I am proofing. Then I paste that into my word processor and make up an errata sheet. I bold the suspect word or phrase and then put my best guess in parens. I've gotten a lot of referrals from an Aussie author who writes sci-fi, fantasy, and erotica, but not under the same name. I know, more than you needed to know. Al has actually done some volunteer proofreading for some of the things I've put up about Amazon press conferences and such, and he, I guarantee you, has an eagle eye. So this, if you're looking for someone who will definitely catch typos and the financial arrangements looks like it would work for you, I recommend it, and I'll have a, I'm not sure I've got a website for him. Why don't you just send me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com and I'll connect you up with Al if you'd like to learn more about his copy editing services. And also another comment a while back, I'm always curious how people are listening to the podcast. I got a great one from Dave Peter in Charlotte, North Carolina. He writes, I came to the Kindle Chronicles via a fraternity brother of mine during one of our golf trips. Once a year, we head to places like Myrtle Beach to play golf for a few days. Anywhere from 6 to 8 of my core friends from college, we refer to the weekend as the Spider Open. That has something to do with the University of Richmond. This must have been around 2010. Could it have been 2009? Time flies. I had a Kindle keyboard, and my buddy had the original iPad. I was arguing how much better of a reading device the Kindle was. Needless to say, there was no winner in the debate, but my buddy did say, you know, you should listen to this one podcast all about the Kindle. Needless to say, I have not missed an episode since. I don't think I even really knew what a podcast was at that point. Back to the question, I listen to the podcast during my Saturday morning workout. It is usually my best workout of the week. I am refreshed after solid Friday night REM and the fact that I am not rushing to get to work. I usually listen to your intro set up during the car ride and then rest on the treadmill, or elliptical. Either way, knowing I have a fresh new Kindle podcast to listen to for the workout definitely puts a little oomph in my gait. I really enjoy it week in, week out. Thanks, Dave Peter in Charlotte. And then he adds, for the record, I own the second-gen Kindle Paperwhite, the fifth-gen Kindle, which I call my outdoor Kindle, and I use the Galaxy Note 3 and Galaxy Note 10.1 2014 for the Kindle Android app. If you've got a, you'd like to sketch where you listen to the Kindle Chronicles, if you've got a routine that would be fun to imagine, it does help with the show. You're just looking at a microphone, and then sometimes you can have images of people on cross trainers or having coffee, all the different ways that people listen to the show. It's really fun to hear those scenarios. You can send them to me at podchronicles@gmail.com. That's it for this week. For next week's show, I will bring you an audio collage of voices from South by Southwest, as I've done in past conferences like the New Media Expo earlier this year in Las Vegas. Just a handful of the 800 sessions and events have anything to do with ebooks or book publishing at all, so I will probably have some other snippets of content from other fields that may be of interest to you. South by Southwest is fantastic. It's all about new ideas, and a new idea can spark related ideas in any field, so I'll try to keep my mind open and share with you what I learned. I checked in with my doctor here in Denver to make sure that I'm not coming down with something serious, and he assured me that I was fit to travel. I told him about Google Glass, and he rolled his eyes, but then he came up with a South by Southwest worthy idea for its evolution. How about a device you could implant in your brain to record your dreams, he suggested. It would be triggered when you go into REM sleep, but by the action of your eyes, and would record the images and words, if any, for future recall by your Jungian dream analyzing therapist. Ridiculous, right? Well, yeah, but when I bend my mind toward the incredible diversity of ideas and startups that South by Southwest lures to Austin each spring, my assumptions about what's possible tend to expand. If you're going to be at South By and would like to set up a rendezvous, please drop me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com with your coordinates, and we'll see if we can't meet for a cup of coffee and the TKC secret handshake, which maybe we can invent together. This is Len Edgerly recording in downtown Denver, Colorado for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.